welcome to everybody. This is the third of four lectures that are being presented as part of the American and New England Studies program American Conversation Series. That was a lot to say. This year we have a focus on the theme of American material culture. Just in case there's anybody here who hasn't met me or has no idea who I am and why I should be talking. Nobody else wanted to do it. No, I'm Nina Silber. I'm Nina Silber, and I'm the new director of the American Studies program. Before I introduce our speaker, I just wanted to say that I'm very happy to see you all here today. I'm also very grateful to my predecessor, Kim Sitchell, who really was sort of the mastermind here behind this lecture series, as well as all the other work she did leading up to the transition. But I'm very grateful for all the work she did and for putting together this lecture series. And so I'll confess, I do feel a little bit like I'm lip syncing here because it's kind of Kim's project and I'm talking. But that's okay. That's okay. Don't forget, too, that the last talk in our Material Culture Lecture Series will be happening on February 21st when Professor Marie Abbe of the Music Department we'll talk about squeeze box stories. I think that's about accordions. So to our main event, I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for this evening. I'm sure many of you know Professor Stephen Prothrow is a professor of religion here at Boston University. He's the author of many, many books, the most recent being The American Bible, How Our Words Unite, Divide, and Define a Nation. Also the author of American Jesus, which I think many of our graduate students have read or encountered at various points. He was the chief consultant for the WGBH PBS series God in America. He's been a commentator in more venues than I could possibly name. Maybe at some point he'll tell us what it's like to talk to Stephen Colbert, because you know, I'm interested in that. And he's also a tweeter. I don't know, does one say you're a tweeter? Is that maybe not the grammatical? Okay. Anyway, he tweets or tweet or whatever you say. This year, Professor Prothrow has been a fellow at the Smithsonian's Museum of American History. And as he explained to me, as sort of to kind of give some idea of what he was going to be talking about, he indicated that he's been interested in the way scholars have told stories about American history, and they have certainly in recent years paid attention to bringing race, class, gender, sexual orientation into their accounts of those stories, but have often slighted, I think it's fair to say, have often slighted religion in that discussion. And so his talk today is going to address his efforts to talk about religion, bring religion into the mix as part of his experiences at the museum. So, welcome, Stephen Prothrow.
Thank you, Nina. So, this isn't really a lecture. It's kind of more like a chat or like a informal conversation. So I'm kind of apologizing at the beginning that this is really kind of more of a story than with some moments of reflection that I hope will invite conversation than it is kind of a full-blown lecture. So it's really a pretty informal talk about my experiences in academia and to some extent on the fringes of academia. And my goal is to get from one picture, this picture, to this picture, and to stimulate some conversation along the way. Now, I don't usually use PowerPoint. In fact, I brag in my classes that I'm PowerPointless, so so I'm not sure how this will go, but I sort of thought since it was American studies and it was material culture, I kind of had to, I wasn't even going to bring an object, I was going to at least bring some pictures. So I'll just back up there for a minute. I was an undergraduate at Yale in the late 70s and early 80s, and I actually started as an astronomy and physics major, and I ended up as an American studies major, which was kind of a big shift, and I attribute the shift entirely to calculus. So that's how I ended up thinking about American history, Religion in American history, religion and politics, all those things that continue to preoccupy me really started when I was an undergraduate who couldn't handle the math in the astronomy and physics major. My teachers were all, I believe, all what we called at the time New Left professors. I don't know if this is even still a term of art, but we understood them to be New Left professors. This meant a few things. One, history was about conflict, wasn't about consensus. So there was a rejection of the consensus school in American history. The second assumption was that movements in the United States that seemed liberal were actually conservative. In other words, FDR's New Deal saved capitalism from itself. It wasn't an assertion of liberal ideals into American culture. It was quite the opposite. There was a focus on race, class, and gender, that we understood that that's what we were studying, that the story of American history was really a story about the playing out of questions of race, class, and gender. And then there was also a focus on material culture. So we were taught to pay attention. I guess I said three things, but those are four things. See, there you go. There's my math in my math problems already, rearing their ugly head. So history is about conflict. Key moments that seemed to be liberal were actually conservative. Race, class, and gender matter, and material culture was an important way to read data. Now, it's interesting to me that religious studies, and I see I have my colleague Anthony Petros here, religious studies, and, religious studies doesn't really, which is my field, doesn't really, it's not really a discipline. It doesn't really have its own methods. It just kind of steals them from other people. So it's what do we call that? It's parasitic, right? And, just recently we're getting around to material culture, but this was in the 70s. This was already what, we were doing in American studies. And so this is how I'm going to get to the clock. In my junior seminar, as an undergraduate, we had an assignment to write about an object. And I wrote about this clock. And when I first started to write about this clock, I thought, how can I possibly write 5 pages about a clock? It's just a clock, it tells time, has a picture of a house on it, it's made out of wood, it has some brass on it. How can I possibly write about this? So I started to research it, and what I learned about this clock is I learned that, and this clock is 1818, and I learned at the start of the 19th century, almost no one in the United States owned a clock. People were on agricultural time, right? They got up when the sun got up, and they took care of their animals and their farm, and they went to bed after the sun went down. If there was a clock in a town, it was usually on a steeple at a church. Clocks were very expensive. They had brass movements inside them. They were expensive to manufacture and to buy. They were made one at a time, on order. They were typically built in tall cases after the British style, not as this clock is a shelf clock to be put on a shelf. And that by the 1840s, clocks were everywhere in the United States. They were there because of the Industrial Revolution and the rise of factories. People had to be at the factory at a certain time, which they never had to be the places in a certain time. Also because of railroads. Railroads had schedules. Railroads kind of invented time in American culture. I also learned about this guy, Eli Terry, who was a Connecticut entrepreneur who made this clock. He built these smaller shelf clocks for the middle class. They had some flourishes that made them feel ritzy, like the brass on the top, like the little curlicues in the woodwork. But they were made out of wood. He pioneered the guts of the clock. The mechanism of the clock was made out of wood, and it was made with interchangeable parts. This was the first time that interchangeable parts were used in American manufacturing outside of wartime. And what this enabled him to do was he could just build a bunch of parts and then put together a bunch of clocks, and if a certain part broke on the clock, they could just put the new part back in. So this enabled you to mass produce these clocks and to make them at scale and to make them inexpensive. He sold them for $15 beginning in 1817, which was expensive, but it was something that was in the reach of a middle-class person in the United States. So I learned from this that objects matter, that you can do a lot more with objects than simply illuminate or illustrate a story, that they can help change the story. So as I got out of undergraduate school, I started to work in graduate school on Asian religion in America, really pretty for a silly reason. I had a seminar in U.S. historiography of American religion, and all the other people took the fun, like the good topics, and the one topic left over was Asian religions in America. I didn't know anything about that at all, but it was kind of assigned to me. It ended up being my academic specialty for most of my career. And as I started working on Buddhism a little bit more after graduate school, I started to see that Buddhism came into the United States through three main paths. One was through texts. This is the way that the transcendentalists like Emerson and Thoreau and others learned about Hinduism and Buddhism. They read and translated, actually. The first translation of a Buddhist scripture in the United States was in the Dial in 1844 by Thoreau. No, it wasn't by Thoreau. I think it was by Elizabeth Peabody, maybe. I could be wrong. I know it was that year, and I know it was in the Dial. So, but there was this, there were these different paths, depending on how Buddhism was encountered. One was this textual path, another was an interpersonal path, which was rare, even in 19th century America, because there weren't Buddhist teachers around that could introduce you to Buddhism. So this was something that really just starts for the most part in the 1960s when you start to get Zen teachers and others coming to the United States. And then there was what I called an artifactual path, a path through objects, in other words, that we see in people like the Boston Buddhists that gave them the MFA, its collections in Asian art, who went to Japan, people like Ernest Fenollosa and William Sturgis Bigelow, who actually both converted to Buddhism. And converted to Buddhism to a great extent because of the beautiful objects that they saw in Buddhist culture. And so that sort of underscored to me, again, the importance of material culture. Then I worked on this book on American Jesus, and it really started for me with this picture, which I encountered in a temple in a Hindu temple in San Francisco. Actually, the first Hindu temple in the United States was built in 1906. It's now called the Old Temple. You can probably figure out why that is. It's right next door to the New Temple in San Francisco. And the whole reason I was studying Hinduism and Buddhism at the time was because I was kind of bored with Christianity. I just wasn't, kind of knew a lot about Christianity. I'd been raised in the Episcopal Church. I found the whole topic rather boring. And but the more I studied Buddhism and Hinduism, the more I kept running into Jesus. And it just seemed like American Buddhists and Hindus were obsessed with this person. And that I couldn't really tell the story of either American Hinduism or American Buddhism without talking about Jesus, quite to my surprise, because I thought, in fact, you probably could just talk about people like the Buddha or Krishna or something when you're talking about these traditions. But it turns out that American Buddhists and American Hindus kind of love Jesus even more than American Christians, and this was one example. This is a picture called Jesus Christ in his yoga posture. It's still there in the old temple in San Francisco. It shows Jesus in the half lotus position. Apparently he wasn't quite good enough at yoga to get into the full lotus position. But it's also a picture that betrays, I think, some Catholic influence, particularly in iconography of Saint Francis. St. Francis out in the wilderness, surrounded by wild animals, some of them dangerous, and yet living peaceably among them. So you've got the birds, and you've got the bunny rabbit by his right knee, and you have the snake under his left knee, and you have a little kind of a snow leopard or something there, off to the left side of his body sleeping. He was there in the wilderness, and he was with the wild beasts. I did a project after that on Asian religions in the United States, and I started collecting some objects. Like, this is an object from the Self-Realization Fellowship in Pacific Palisades, California, and you see there's Jesus there Can anyone tell me which one's Jesus? You also have, with Jesus in the middle, an image of Krishna, and then to the right side, as we're looking at it, is Swami Yogananda. He was the founder of this group called the Self-Realization Fellowship, which was the largest Hindu group in America between 1925 and the late 1950s. And then his guru is the guy on the left, person who kind of initiated him into his particular version of Hinduism. So I got interested in collecting some of these objects. But I also got interested in other images of Jesus from my American Jesus book. This, by the way, is Jesus. If you're not so sure about that, you can see it says Savior. And then in his right glove, it says Mercy. And then he's got a mark on his side, right? The mark when Jesus was pierced by the lance at the crucifixion. That's there too. This is part of my American Jesus book when I was trying to see how Jesus was pictured here by Hindus, here by Hindus, here by Christians. Here in the most famous picture of Jesus, this is Head of Christ by Warner Solomon. Some people say this is the second most reproduced image in world history. One estimate, I think, has that it's been reproduced 500 million times or something like that. Second probably to Chairman Mao, image of Chairman Mao. But this was very popular, really, between the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. So a few years ago, or a few years after this American Jesus book came out, that was really prompted by that, seeing that Hindu picture and asking, you know, why is it that in America, Buddhists and Hindus seem so obsessed with Jesus? That was my working problem. And then through that book, I tracked, which, by the way, it's an American studies book. It is an American studies book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like more than, not anything else I've really written has really actually been in my undergraduate degree, really, but that's a straightforward, I would argue, straightforward American studies book. It's a cultural history of Jesus that follows images of Jesus throughout American history. In the first half of the book, in the Christian idioms, where Jesus, I argue, follows cultural, social norms, right? Not something any historian would be surprised by, but you know, often religious people like to think that their divinities are just, internal truths that don't really change, right? Jesus is the same yesterday, today, and forever. So I tracked the way preoccupations of Jesus shifted with the time. So when we're in the Spanish-American War and football is becoming our national pastime and Frederick Remington is drawing pictures of cowboys and Indians, you know, Jesus all of a sudden gets macho and masculine and he takes off his shirt and he shows up in the carpenter's shop and he shows you how ripped his muscles are and he starts throwing the money changers out of the temple. And when we, you know, move into the 60s and 70s, Jesus becomes a hippie on the cover of Time magazine and, you know, Jesus Christ Superstar and Godspell. And then the second half of the book, I looked at Jesus in other populations among Mormons, among Hindus and Buddhists and Jews and things like that. So after that book came out, I was approached by people at WGBH to consult with them about how to do religion on public television. And this was also after 9/11, and there was a sense that American culture had kind of been caught blindsided by Islam, and we really didn't know anything about Islam, and all of a sudden we needed to know something about Islam. So there was a push to sort of brainstorm, and one of the ideas that came out of those meetings that were held in Harvard Square, 10 years ago or 8 years ago, was to create this series called God in America, where they would track the religion story alongside the secular story about religion and about America, and see the ways in which religion influenced American history. That was the project. So the film ran from Pueblo Indians and Ann Hutchison and the Puritans to Jerry Falwell and Barack Obama's first inaugural. And along the way, there were conversations about the First Amendment, about Thomas Jefferson's idea of the wall of separation of church and state, about Catholic efforts to get the real Bible in the public schools instead of the fake Bible in the public schools, about the religion of Abraham Lincoln, Reform Judaism, fundamentalism in the Scopes trial, Billy Graham and American presidents, John F. Kennedy's speech that made Rick Santorum wretch about church and state, Martin Luther King, of course. And the main argument was just that religion played a major role in American history, so you can't understand American history without understanding the role that religion played in it. And what happened to get to the Smithsonian is the people at the National Museum of American History saw this series, and they took this argument to heart, and they said, yeah, you know, we have not done that here. We haven't sufficiently taken account of religion. We have heard from our colleagues in American studies we should attend to race, which they have done, and we should attend to ethnicity, and we should attend to class, and to gender, and to some extent to sexual orientation, although I think that's still coming at the National Museum of American History. And they took seriously this charge that religion mattered, and they realized that they really didn't know much about what they had in their collections, and they wanted to know more, and they wanted me to consult with them on how to do that. So I approached Boston University and the dean's office, and they allowed me to do this, which was very generous of them, on the one condition that I come and talk with this group today. So yeah,
I'll sign off on it now.
Yeah. So that was one of the conditions. And I had a few tasks. One was to try to inventory a little bit what they had. And this seemed to me very easy. You know, I would just get on a computer and I would like plug in like religion, or I would plug in some keywords, and all of a sudden I would find out what they have. But, you know, the Smithsonian Institution is a very old institution, and it has hundreds of millions of objects. And when it was being, and various elements of it have morphed and moved around over time. So whole collections have sometimes stayed with one museum and sometimes shifted with another museum. And most of the things that were collected over time were collected by individual curators based on one principle and one principle alone, and that is their own idiosyncratic intellectual interests. So there's a massive collection of lace in the National Museum of American History. Absolutely massive. And I'm sure for people who are interested in lace, it's fascinating. But probably never any of it is ever going to be exhibited in any exhibit. It could be that one piece will sometime be exhibited. But there was a person who spent, you know, 20, 25 years making this collection of lace. And when people cataloged the objects, they would catalog them by the date of acquisition, and they would catalog them with a number that came in, and they would have a short description. They typically would not get any backstory of the, you know, how the object came to be. And now when the National Museum of American History displays anything, they won't really display anything without a story. That's what they're trafficking in stories. So most of the objects they've gathered over the last century are useless to them, because it'll just say something like, you know, Mormon shoes. You know, or it might even not say that. It might say Utah Territory shoes. And you're going to have to like figure out that they're Mormon shoes. But they're not going to come along with any name or anything like that. But the biggest problem with the trying to figure out what was there for me, and this I haven't finished my job there, is that there hasn't been any system for cataloging anything there. You sort of imagine like the Smithsonian, it's the National Museum of American History, and they're all like, they must be really good at everything. It's sort of like that guy's book about the O.J. Simpson trial. The book was called Outrage by Vincent Bugliosi or something like that. You know, where he said, you know, you assume that certain people are good at their jobs, right? And one of the things you assume people are good at is prosecutors, right? They're like tough and prosecuting attorneys. They know what they're doing, you know. So you just assume, and he's like, no, most people are bad at their jobs, and that includes prosecutors. Most of them are bad. And in this case, there was just a bad prosecutor. And I don't mean to say that the curators at the National Museum are bad, but they just are not very good at. Here's another way to put it. People weren't thinking about how another human would find an object that they collected. That seems to me, if an object is lost in the Smithsonian, and I've been in their, what do they call them? Their storage areas. And their storage areas are the size of football fields. You know, you'll go in, it'll be like one football field, and you go in another, you know, the floor above is another football field after football field. If the person is dead or has lost their memory who collected this object, or if the object has moved since the last time that living person knew where it was, if it's not cataloged in a certain way, no one is ever going to find it. It's functionally not there. It's like one of those, if a tree falls in the woods, you know, if you have an object but there's no way to find it, do you really have it in the museum? So that was one really interesting thing to me, and I started to think a lot about, and I'm sure people who do library science and things or curating science, you know, think a lot about this. But it was a curiosity to me to think about how, you know, when you catalog a book, there's a clear standard of how you catalog a book. You know, you catalog it by publisher, by title, by author, by year. There's a lot missing in that. You don't know what any given chapter is on until we get to the Google Books, you know, generation. But you don't. You actually, there is a lot missing in that form of cataloging a book. You could have an entire chapter in a book on a subject you're researching. It could be the only book in the world on which you have such a chapter on, say, a biography of a person, and you wouldn't know how to find it through that cataloging, through that system of cataloging. But the cataloging of objects is even weirder, because people will catalog them, again, according to their quirks. So they might catalog an object based on what it's made of, right? It's a silver object. It's a colonial silver object. You know, and then somebody might say, well, it's actually a colonial silver object made by Paul Revere, you know, or made in Boston by Paul Revere. And then maybe it's from the Old North Church in Boston. And maybe it turns out it's actually a chalice that's used in communion services at the Old North Church in Boston. So it just depends how much information they're gonna get, right? Is it a Cadillac Brougham car, or is it Michael Jackson's catalog Brougham car? Right, those are two very different objects, depending again on how they're cataloged. And the Smithsonian does have cars, and it has houses, and it has, you know, has things like that. So what I learned so far is that the National Museum of American History has huge holdings in colonial and early national Southwestern Catholicism, Spanish-speaking objects, particularly in a lot from Puerto Rico. And I went through a lot of these objects, a lot of santos and images of the three kings that are very popular in Puerto Rico. I learned that there's a lot of Judaica, including hundreds and maybe thousands of Yahrzeit plaques, which are plaques that are used to commemorate the one-year anniversary of the death of a Jewish person. I learned there's a lot of Russian icons from Russian Orthodoxy, and lots of rosaries and crucifixes from Catholicism. Now, one thing that governs those are the only areas in which this museum has actually collected in religion. One thing that governs that is that actually none of those things were collected as religious objects. They were all collected as ethnic objects. Right? They're evidence of the life of a people. So the approach was anthropological. Right? You have these peoples, you want to know something about them. Oh, there's this distinctive thing. These people wear crucifixes, right? These people speak Spanish. These people make pictures of the three, you know, kings. So we should collect those things as evidence of their peoplehood, right? So religion, the category of religion that I'm interested in, you know, crosses ethnicities, right? And but the only things that are showing up in this museum are the things that have been collected for non-religious reasons, or for maybe a-religious reasons. I found that there was nothing there I found zero, actually, in the museum on Islam. Zero that I would, not one object that I would characterize as an Islamic object. I found, I think this is the next one, yes. I found this. This was one of two Hindu objects in the National Museum of American History. And it's a Kali lunchbox. That's Kali there with the red mouth. And it's actually a very modern picture of Kali, a very cleaned up. If you know iconography of her at all, usually she has blood dripping out of her mouth, and she has garlands of skulls around her neck, and she has a sort of, I don't know what you call it, if it's like a necklace around your waist, but it has decapitated heads hanging off of there. She's a terrific, scary goddess. She's kind of cleaned up here to look sort of pretty, except for the tongue's a little odd. I found a lunchbox by her, like made in the 2000s, that, and a similar lunchbox made by the same company of Krishna, another Hindu divinity. So it was kitsch. It was somebody who was collecting religious kitsch. I also found this, Buddha at his laptop. That was the only object in the museum that was Buddhist. Now, there are objects in the Smithsonian that are Buddhist that are categorized under art, not in the National Museum of American History. But those would be, older, non-American images. I also found that there is an altar that was made out of salvaged wood in one of the internment camps in World War II by Japanese-American Buddhists in the Buddhist Churches of America. That are the only two Buddhist objects I'm able to find in the museum. See, to me, this is really interesting, really fascinating. Like, really? In the Smithsonian, National Museum of American History, you don't have anything on these subjects? But even more surprising to me than the fact that there's nothing on Islam, Buddhism, and Hinduism is that there's almost nothing about Protestantism. Either black or white. There's a little bit about the civil rights movement. I found about 24 church fans. You know church fans? Mm. They're just the kind of things that somebody who doesn't know much about religion would sort of think, oh, we should collect those. You know, they're colorful. You know, they have an ad on the back. You know, black people use them in the South to keep themselves cool in the church service, you know. I found about 24 with Martin Luther King on them. I found about 36 that is Jesus knocking at your door. In fact, I might have, yeah, there we go. Jesus knocking at your door. I found about 24 of those. I was asked also by the curators who hired me to look for things to deaccession, because it's very expensive to hold all this stuff. So I said, well, I think we can deaccession some of the Jesus knocks at your door church fans. You know, we don't necessarily need all of those. But really interesting to me, almost nothing has been collected in what I consider to be the dominant religious impulse in American history, which is evangelicalism. Almost nothing about revivalism. Nothing about Billy Graham, for example, you know, who's kind of a well-known person. You know, you might think of a way to incorporate him into all sorts of exhibits at the Smithsonian, exhibits on the Cold War, exhibits on Eisenhower, exhibits on JFK, exhibits on Obama, exhibits on social movements, all sorts of things. So very little about Protestantism, almost nothing about revivalism. Nothing I found about Episcopalians, despite the fact that a third of our presidents are Episcopalian, and until recently when the Supreme Court was overtaken by Catholics, almost all of our people on the Supreme Court, close to half, were Episcopalians. So currently I'm writing up a draft of my report on the collections, and I'm recommending working and obtaining specific material. So this would be at the level of, you ought to go to the old temple in San Francisco and find something from that first Hindu temple. You ought to go to the first Sikh Gurdwara worship center in Stockton, California, and you should see if you can find something there. You should go to the Buddhist Churches of America, which changed its name from the Buddhist Mission of North America to the Buddhist Churches of America in the middle of World War II because of the internment of Japanese Americans, and you should see what they have in their archives that you could acquire. So this has been kind of fun. It's been sort of like, what would I want for Christmas if I were, if I were at the museum? And it's fascinating because if the Smithsonian Institution calls up people, pretty much people listen when the Smithsonian, hi, I'm calling from the Smithsonian, I want your father's Bible, pretty much people care about that. Although I should say that they did tell me, that it's actually much easier to acquire objects from the individual, the actual person, than it is from their kids. So, you know, Billy Graham is about to, and Billy Graham's old, and, you know, and I've been saying to them, you know, you should go talk to Billy Graham, you know, before you have to talk to Franklin Graham. Do you really want to talk to Franklin Graham about, you know, getting this this stuff, you know? So the other thing that I've been doing is working on exhibitions. So they said they wanted me to help with building their collections for future exhibitions, but they also wanted me to help with specific exhibitions. So there's two that I'm working on. The main one is called Roots and Roots. That's spelled R-O-U-T-E-S, R-O-O-T-S. The idea is movement and home, right? Home and movement in a way. And then there's another exhibition on democracy, which is, I don't really know exactly what it's about, but I think it's to some extent about the history of citizenship. At least that's one of the features of it. I've been working on it less. The Roots exhibition is about immigration and migration, so it's about coming to America, but then it's also about moving around inside the United States. And those migrations might be forced in both cases, like forced to come here as in slavery, or forced to move here as in the movements of Native Americans. It also has to do with incorporation, so people who are living in the Utah territories, and who are living in the you know, Salt Lake Basin when it becomes the Utah territories, they're getting incorporated into the United States, so that is being, that's all being considered. My job on this is to push the curators to see religion as a lens through which to interpret their topic. So I'm trying to suggest specific moments that would fit with their broad exhibition. So for example, in talking to the people about citizenship, I said, well, there's these two Supreme Court cases, one in 1922, in which a Japanese American was told he couldn't be a citizen because he wasn't white, and because the Constitution is open citizenship to white persons, and the actual theory in the 1922 case, Ozawa v. United States, was that Ozawa wasn't white because he wasn't Caucasian, because white meant Caucasian. And so Indian Americans, there weren't that many in the United States at the time, but maybe about 7,000, were excited about the Supreme Court ruling in 1922, because they said, well, we're Caucasians. Everybody knows we're Caucasians. And by all the race theories in the 20s, the most Caucasian people in the world were Indians, because it was from the Caucasus that were like running, you know, up over in Northern Europe, over into Northern India. Like, that was the definition of Caucasian. Like, they were more Caucasian than I am. And so so there was this case, U.S. versus Thind in 1923, where Thind went into the Supreme Court and he said, look, you know, and he was actually a Sikh, he wasn't a Hindu. He was called a Hindu, which is the term that Americans used at the time for Indians, for people from India, you know, were called Hindus. But he, by religion, he was a Sikh. And he was denied his citizenship because the Supreme Court decided 1 year later, after it said, you were white if you were Caucasian, they said, well, we know you're Caucasian, but actually what we meant to say was that you're white by the common understanding of white. Not by technical. We know technically you're white, but the common understanding is you're not white. The common understanding is you're brown. You know, you're from India, everybody knows you're not, obviously not white. So I've been pushing them to try to include, think about those as possibilities. And then I've been talking about the migration of Mormon migrations out to the great, you know, Salt Lake Basin, which was a pretty massive undertaking and very controversial and provoked, you know, U.S. Supreme Court attention and the attention of Congress and the attention of multiple U.S. presidents, including Abraham Lincoln. So that's part of what I've been doing there. One thing that I've been intrigued by is the politics of the Smithsonian and how there are certain things that are utterly, totally intellectually defensible that aren't even conceivable to talk about in a museum, I mean, in the Smithsonian Museum. So for example, when we were doing talking about the Roots exhibition, I was saying, well, okay, so like, where do we start? Like, we have people coming across the Bering Straits, right? Is that what's going on? And they're like, no. No one ever comes across the Bering Straits. You know, Native Americans are here. They've always been here. And I'm like, no, that's not true. and they say, listen, there's the National Museum of the American Indian. And at the National Museum of the American Indian, American Indians have always been here. And then I started saying more, and they said, we're not going to go there. We're not going to talk about this. You're right, but we're not going to talk about this. So this is really interesting to me, that the Smithsonian is a lot like a university, in that it's segmented into its silos. It always has language about de-siloing itself, right? How it's going to become interdisciplinary. But it always resists that de-siloing of itself, because the people who have power and control it inside their silos, so they have no reason really to move outside their silos. It has that. But it has, and academia is politicized, but it has, it's much, the Smithsonian is much more politicized because it's answerable to political actors in other Smithsonian units. Right? This would be a little bit like, you know, if Anthony is going to write a book, we might be looking over his shoulder a little bit in the Department of Religion, but not very much. But no one in the physics department is going to be looking over his shoulder. But in the Smithsonian, the physics department is looking over your shoulder while you're doing your work. It's very bizarre. So every exhibition sort of in any of the museums can be vetted and sort of torpedoed by people in others if there isn't a certain orthodoxy or something that's adhered to. You know, no, you can't use that portrait that way. You know, you can't do that. You know, you can't say the Bering Straits thing. That's not allowed. Yeah. It's really interesting to me.